and welcome to episode 442 of the Creating Crowbar, a gaming podcast being recorded on the 21st of January, 2025. Or is it 2016? Or 1933? I get my dates all muddled up. Anyway, I'm Marsh Davis, a worthless, decaying relic from a faded age, and joining me tonight is the glittering and precious treasure hiding a dark and terrible curse, Jamie Britton.
Hello.
Hello, Jamie.
Happy New Year, Marsh.
When your remains get displayed in a museum in a thousand years' time, Jamie, do you have like a preference of form factor? Would you prefer to be like a desiccated mummy or maybe a bog man?
I'd quite like to be that guy in the British Museum who's all dried up and is just lying in some sand and basically looks like he's doing this. Ah! I would like my last pathetic moments of mortal agony to be surrounded by Chinese tourists, all staring at my naked remains.
I think that's doable. Is that the bog man that you're thinking of? One of the bog
men. Is he the bog man?
Don't know.
He doesn't give bog vibes. He's more
of a dry form factor.
Absolutely. He looks horrible. Mm. And I took my 8-year-old daughter there quite recently and she was having a look at him and it's like, it's just a dead body. I mean, I know it's 40,000 years old, but I am just showing my daughter a dead body.
Yeah. A learning experience. That's education.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, guess where I am tonight, Marsh?
Well, I know, so guessing would be a mere performance on my part, but I can pretend to ignorance if you like. Where are you, Jamie?
So, as I have discussed on pods of the past, I record most of these from Warwick, where I work 2 days a week, and that means I have taken a tour over the last couple of years of many of the Warwick's creepiest bed and breakfasts, hostelries and hotels. But tonight I am staying in the hotel which is attached to Warwick Castle. Now, Warwick Castle is a big deal for the people of Warwick in a way that has made me never want to look at it or see it at all because they're just so into it. I'm sure it's lovely. But I am in the grounds of said castle in their hotel. And listeners can't see me, but Marsh can see the heraldry on the wall behind me. Above my bed, there is a shield with a knight on it.
Is it like a faux Bayeux tapestry on the other wall?
Yes, that's right. And then there's also kind of medieval sort of manuscript art in the bathroom. and the portraits in the reception move and talk.
What kinds of things do they say?
I didn't stop to listen. I wanted to get to my room and have a big poo. but they were there and they were moving. And then after I'd done that, I it's weird, right? Because we're in the grounds of Warwick Castle. I can't see the castle and it is functionally a reskinned travel lodge. However, I did get to walk out of the hotel along a narrow wooden walkway to a fake medieval tavern where I had a cheeseburger and chips and a Diet Coke in a room which was playing frantic lute music. To an entirely empty room, apart from one couple sat at the bar who were talking to the bar lady who was standing there tolerating them. And she was saying things that I couldn't quite hear. And the man was with her who was saying, oh, you can't say that. You can't say that, which is obviously the internationally recognized sign of someone's doing some racism in this hotel bar. So, yeah, that's what I did. It's very strange, but kind of sweet as well. So I recommend the Warwick Castle Hotel.
I mean, I wish I could be more cynical about it than I am, but I'm so into it. I'm partly into it because the medieval theming, but also I noticed you've got a bunk bed, which is just innately exciting.
I've got a set of bunk beds in case I make two tiny friends. And I've got pillows that have a picture of a castle on them. So it's all very exciting. It's in a weird way, it's the least haunted hotel I've stayed at in Warwick, which is funny because of all the old-timey theming. But I'll let you know if there's any visitations.
Well, maybe those portraits weren't actually moving. They were just haunted. You just walked past the ghosts, assuming they were some sort of very trying interactive exhibit.
There's a sign on one of the lifts that said, this lift isn't working, please use the other lift. And I just thought, ooh. that takes me back to the olden times. Anyway, that's where I am.
It seems like almost too painfully apt, Jamie, but let us talk of the best Nazi punching game of the moment.
Please let's.
Indiana Jones and the Great Circle. You have played some of this? Is that correct?
I have played some of it, yes.
I have finished it, and I have enjoyed it. It is a globe-trotting, mostly first-person action-adventure from Machine Games, who were known previously for their Wolfenstein reboot. I think it's, you might have to correct me here, but I think it's set after Raiders of the Lost Ark, but before The Last Crusade?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Because I was surprised recently when I found out the Temple of Doom, despite being the second film, is actually chronologically the first in the fiction. But
that is correct. It is a racist prequel.
Yes. Well, this is it's very true to Indiana Jones, but it is not true to that aspect of Indiana Jones. Thankfully, we see Indiana Jones. He's like smarting after after a breakup with Marion from the first film, and he throws himself headlong into this pursuit of an artifact stolen from the institute at which he works. And the journey takes him to fascist Italy and Egypt and the Himalayas and beyond in this race to uncover the secrets of the ancient world before they can fall into the hands of and be turned to evil purposes by the fucking Nazis. And like, people are saying, besides being a game, this is the best Indiana Jones movie since The Last Crusade. And I tend to agree, even though I did really enjoy Dial of Destiny. I mean, I know you haven't played a huge amount of it, but what is your sense of that? Do you think it's so far staying really true to Indiana Jones?
Yeah, I think so. I think they have clearly thought very, very deeply about how to recreate that kind of cinematic vibe. The way they've done it is counterintuitive, like, which is kind of reassuring, I think. Like, they haven't done an Uncharted-like, which would kind of be covering a cover version. They haven't done a Tomb Raider. Again, that would be the same. Like, they've done a first-person kind of Dishonored-type thing with lots of cutaways. It's like, it's unusual and interesting. And from what I've played of it, it works. Like, that's quite surprising. You know, having worked in video games for a little while now, knowing that things like transitioning from one point of view to another in a way that doesn't make players feel sick or annoyed, and that, you know, preserves kind of the momentum of gameplay is just very, very hard. And I feel like it's a new kind of vibe for this team, even though they've done, you know, kind of cinematic first person stuff before. Like, it's never been this elaborate or elegant, I don't think. So that was kind of my main takeaway from what I've played is how well it sits.
Yeah, I mean, just it's a small thing, but the way it does transition from occasional like third person views of Indiana Jones, which happen during cutscenes, but also when you are performing particular actions in the environment, like climbing stuff. And the way it transitions from that into first person is just incredibly unfussy, almost instantaneously. Sometimes it's a hard cut straight into the brain of Indiana Jones, and sometimes the camera sort of pans in briefly before cutting. And it's, I don't know, it's an incredibly small thing, but it's just, you can feel that some attention has been paid to the way that it embodies you as this character who you are so familiar with seeing from the outside.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, the first person perspective is weird. Like, you're sort of sat, like you say, you're sort of sat in the face of someone. It's kind of a strange idea. And often that's been kind of dealt with by giving people, like, you know, having your silent protagonists or mostly silent protagonists, but actually having someone who's chatting away. I mean, they've done it very well before with Blazkowicz, but like, doing it with a character that people know and love and who has someone else's voice, it all feels very bold and brave, I think, in a way that quite a lot of kind of tentpole releases recently have kind of tended to shy away from.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, it's tempting to think that Machine Games got the license purely on the basis of their Nazi thumping credentials. But like, because I don't know that I otherwise would have said, looking at the Wolfenstein games, oh yes, these are the folks to make, you know, a matinee adventure game with the chirpy spirit of the Spielberg films. But they, it really pairs extremely well with their talents. Like, they capture a lot of who Indy is. But I think what you're saying about them making bold choices, I mean, because it, inevitably you spend a lot more time sitting with Indy, as it were, in a video game, which is, you know, has large contiguous spaces of time. Scenes just don't, you know, aren't like 3 minute things and then cut. You know, you're spending a lot of time with these characters in a single moment. And so they have this space to kind of explore more about who Indy is and what he does. And they really walk an incredibly delicate line by staying true to the films and paying homage to them as well, without simply echoing them, but yet also being confident enough that they can sort of add to them as well without feeling desperately alien or inappropriate. And I think that's an astonishing achievement, I think, that part alone.
You know, the exercise of working out what, like, Indiana Jones's moveset actually is, like, what his verbs are. Like, for me, if I was asked that question, I would probably say that, like, the draw of those movies is a mixture of kind of fun mystery solving and kind of rolling escalatory action sequences that kind of you know, transition from one location into another in a way that kind of builds chaotic kind of tension as it goes. And the game has some of that, but it's, you know, it's also not that as well, right? It's got a kind of the sort of stealth body hidey, you know, throw pot at Nazi head thing is kind of, it's not really what he do, but it seems to make a lot of sense in play.
Yeah, it's a mixture of things, isn't it? It's partly a stealth game. It's partly a sort of action platformer, others, and a very light puzzle game, and to, up to a point, a combat game. And all, like all of those verbs are contained in the films. But I mean, because it's a game, you do have to sit with those sort of modes longer than you would in a film. So making sure that one doesn't totally outbalance the others and prevent like the jest out from evoking the films is really important. And it's interesting that they've sort of chosen as the default mode to be this sort of open world social stealth thing, because the game frequently places you in these large, extremely open environments where there's a mix of civilian zones where Indy can move freely and prohibited areas where he can't, at least not without a disguise. And that, like, that does happen in the films, and it's like it's a key point in the films that occurs. Like when he's in Egypt, he's dressed up, digging away at the tombs, and he steals a Nazi uniform at the submarine base at a later stage. So that stuff kind of does happen, but like I don't think, I mean, it feels like it's a reliable part of the films, but it doesn't feel like that is a signature beat of Indiana Jones. And yet, in the context of this game, it feels completely natural to me that, you know, Indy spends most of the time, at least in the first few hours, dressed as a Vatican priest, ziplining around the rooftops of the Vatican and saying hello to nuns and cats before, you know, like braining a fascisti with a mandolin. Somehow that really captures it, even though that's not exactly what you would describe the films as being about.
No, it's funny. I remember I just had to Google the name because there was an Indiana Jones game that came out in 1999, which was called Indiana Jones and the Infernal Machine, which made by LucasArts. And it was like a kind of, yes, it was their riposte to Tomb Raider. Yeah. And I remember it being like, it had a good bit at the beginning where you use your whip and it plays the fanfare while you go jump across a chasm, right? And then the rest of the game was doing Tomb Raider stuff. So walking around, solving puzzles, or in my case, just not solving puzzles, failing to solve puzzles and then not playing the game again. But you really didn't feel like Indiana Jones because you were mostly just silent and walking around abandoned areas and occasionally with a really bad actor doing the voice, you know, who sounded, you know, slightly more like Harrison Ford than I do, but only a little bit. And, you know, it was just ultimately, you know, probably a well put together game by the standards of the time, but like, yeah, didn't have any of the vibes of Indiana Jones really. So it's it's great that they've, you know, managed to kind of conjure that stuff so well. And in such a counterintuitive way. I think that's the thing that's so impressive about it, is that, like, there would have been a way to make it an Uncharted-like, and they didn't do that. They did what they do best, you know.
Well, I think the game is at its best when it isn't doing that stuff. Because when it is doing the sort of the social stealth ziplining around Vatican, you know, that kind of thing, it's doing the things that are most uniquely itself. Whereas when it gets into there are like fairly linear tomb raidery, tomb diving, platform puzzles and so forth, and other linear spectacles. But like, I mean, even though indie is like the root intertext for Uncharted and Tomb Raider and so forth, they've been around for a long time. And so I've been playing those exact sorts of levels since 1996. So playing them in the context of it being an Indiana Jones game isn't actually as innately enthralling as you might think. Whereas all this other stuff around Indiana Jones, where he's palling around with his priest friend Antonio, or this enterprising journalist called Gina, that feels just so much more interesting immediately. That's the kind of the best parts of these games, apart from, of course, the walloping of Nazis, which is absolutely super. Like, you can hit Nazis in this with such a wide variety of objects. It's so gratifying. Good shovel, excellent. Clonk, big cast iron frying pan. Clang, toilet plunger. You can hit with a toilet plunger. The guitar wasn't as satisfying as I'd hoped, actually. But you can't really knock off marks for that, because you can hit people with a spatula or a bell. You can ring a bell against them. My favorite was the sledgehammer, though, which is a ubiquitous tool. There's just something, a really satisfying finality to it, you know? Indy says sometimes after clonking a Nazi, things like, off to the dreamlands. But mate, that fascist has definitely skipped the dreamlands. He's gone straight and permanently to hell.
Yeah, you just someone in the head with a sledgehammer, they are.
They are dead.
They're very much dead. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested to know what you think about the kind of the level of brutality and lethality in this. Does that fit with how you feel about the films? Because they are quite lethal films. Like, a lot of Nazis get murked in the films.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because, like, Indiana Jones totally kills that guy with a big sword. And I can't remember exactly who that guy is, but he's not a Nazi. I mean, he's an angry guy with a big sword, but, like... You know.
Played by Pat Roach, who dies in a large number of different circumstances, of different characters across the Indiana Jones franchise.
Is he the big lad who gets killed with the helicopter blades?
Yes, by the... Is it a helicopter, or is it some kind of weird plane, isn't it? A big triangle plane.
Yeah, it's funny. They are very lethal movies, actually. And also in that way of Spielberg... He's got like he's a real, he's not really thought of as such, but he's a real like splatter junkie is you know, Spielberg. I mean, I guess he has thought of that, you know. Jaws has all those great gory moments, and you've got your melting faces and your aging things, and the movie Munich, which is a very, very violent movie. Yeah, I think they've always just had a lot of fun with violence, those movies, and not even just violence against, like, the deserving. It's always just been very happy, like, this guy's wearing a fez, like, bam, he's gone, you know. this monkey's a bit evil, boom, it's poisoned. It's just part of their kind of, what's the sort of, I can't remember the name of the sort of genre that they're drawn from, but those kind of 1930s sort of short film strip things, which would have that kind of rollicking adventure vibe to it. I think the way that they work so well is they kind of add Nazis into the equation, right? Which just gives it a little bit more of a hint of danger. I think it's... It's weird. It doesn't feel as cognitively dissonant or ludically dissonant as it might do, because, yeah, just stupid violence has always kind of been part of Indiana Jones's MO, really.
It does. It does tick up across the course of the game. I have to say, where you are now is my favorite part of the game, the exploring this open world Vatican. I didn't, as you progress through the game, the stealth challenges become harder and combat becomes harder. At the beginning of the game, you can take down any of these weakling Italian fascisti with like a couple of swings. But then later in the game, it becomes, you know, you won't knock them out immediately, which means that combat becomes protracted and there's a much greater chance of them alerting other people. Suddenly you're being inundated basically by lots and lots of combatants who will line up to have a biff at you. But it didn't really make sense to me. Like that level of combat aggression didn't feel great. Maybe it's because it didn't, at least for me, effectively tutorialize blocking and dodging, because you can take out the enemy so quickly at the beginning that you don't really need to. And then maybe I just never really internalized that. But it's like later in the game when you have to block, sometimes your arms don't seem to change position, so it's hard to read. And then sometimes you deflect damage and sometimes you don't. I just like it's kind of embarrassing because it took me 23 hours to play the game and I still didn't really understand like one of the core mechanics. And this is probably a me problem because I've heard other people say that it's incredibly fun and they don't feel like it's any kind of punishment to break stealth and just wail on people. But I just found it either like unsurvivable or very laborious towards the end, because you it just takes ages to mince through all these Nazis, and then you just have to spend ages applying bandages and then finding other bandages to replace your stash of bandages. And I turned the difficulty down to easy, but it didn't seem to make a great deal of difference, because it doesn't, the sliders for difficulty don't affect either incoming damage or enemy health. It's about how long it takes to get spotted, and there's a couple of other things like how many enemies attack you at once. So it is easier, but it's not those aren't the things that were my bugbears for somebody who wanted a more trivial combat experience or less time consuming combat experience.
Yeah, it doesn't have the kind of pressure release valve of Dishonored, right? Because basically at any moment in Dishonored, you can get bored of trying to do things stealthily or carefully and just turn into a murder demon and tear everyone to pieces, and same in if you play Hitman or something like that, you have a sort of social stealth game that if you really want to and you don't care about, sort of doing things stealthily, you can just, bring out a rocket launcher and start exploding heads or whatever. Indiana Jones isn't going to do that. So I guess they have a bit more punishing fail states along with that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I actually wondered if it was like the difficulty level was bugged out at one point, because there's this, I won't spoil anything, but there's a boss battle at some point in the game where you have to pop out of stealth and hit the enemy with like a weapon and then scurry away again before they can attack you. And I timed it because it ultimately took me 16 minutes of doing this to beat the enemy, and presumably, like, I'd imagine, I don't know, like, conservatively, I would have probably hit the enemy at least three times a minute, probably more, but at least three times a minute. So that's like a minimum of 48 individual attacks, and like your weapons break after.
That wasn't you like dying and having to reload. That was no, this is 16 minute continuous boss battle.
Yep. Yeah, just doing the same thing over and over again. And there's no feedback at all to tell you that this is being remotely successful. So like when I first tried it, I quit after like, I don't know, 7 minutes or something like this. I was like, okay, I'm not figuring this out. I'll just look up what I'm meant to do. And it was that. I was doing what Reddit says I should do. But it just took 16 minutes with no feedback, and then it finally works, and you're like, oh, okay. But that's a really strange decision. If that's
on purpose, then that is a hilarious decision. Even like the most hardcore boss battles in like Dark Souls or something, or like if you do them right, they're 5 minutes at the very most. It's like 16 minutes is a nightmare.
Yeah, well, it wasn't hard either. Once you know what you're just doing,
16 it's just, tedious minutes.
Yeah, very, very curious. I don't. There's some curiosities with the way that the combat played out for me. I'm not sure that's canon, as it were. The part of the game you're in at the moment is just so amazing. Just this beautiful, sumptuous recreation of the Vatican. There's so much detail to it. There's so many places that you can just not go to as well, which feels just extraordinarily decadent. Like you should be going around the game and inspecting every prop just to, you know, do justice to the developers. But like, you can't redo that because there's, you know, sometimes you're in a hurry as indie and as a player, but, and some areas are just difficult to inspect probably because they're under guard and they're hard to access. And so you can't go around appreciating everything, but I just feel like it's like, you know, you've had this huge banquet and you've just ordered the cheese course just so you can stub your cigar out on the Stilton. You know, it just feels so wasteful. This enormity of beautiful stuff that they've created for you that you just don't need to appreciate.
It's funny with machine games, right? Because I think they're clearly, like, in many dimensions, one of the most talented game teams out there. And like their, I talked about it on the podcast, but their like campaigns that they've done for Quake 2 and Quake 1 recently are spectacularly good, brilliant, like just buzzing with ideas and creativity. And I feel like it's the wrong thing to say because it's not true, but it's just personally like Indiana Jones. I love Indiana Jones. It's never going to rock my world, right? It's just not my thing, really. And also with the Wolfenstein games, right? They're really well made. They're really well done. The writing, the characters, everything about them is like really, really top tier. Again, it's just not quite for me for whatever reason. And I'm really looking forward to them, whatever they do next, basically, because I feel like they've been slightly, I don't know, they've been working in a particular form for a long time. This game like breaks them out of that very significantly and gives them kind of, you know, a whole other property to kind of express themselves with. And they, you know, more or less knocked it out of the park. And I think I'm very excited to kind of see what they do. You know, I don't think they're going to make another Indiana Jones game. I assume they're going to do something entirely different. And I just, yeah, I think they have a lot of really incredible talent that, for me, has been a little bit inaccessible, and I'd like to see kind of where they go next with it.
I mean, I really love the Wolfenstein games. I'd be happy with them making another Indiana Jones game. I think there's probably room for that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the films are shit now, so... Oh, no, you like the film, sorry.
Well, I mean, I like the last one. I liked it on the scale of having been deeply disappointed by the preceding one, so yeah. It was okay. Yeah, it's okay.
Didn't actually see the last one, so I'm just being hateful for the sake of being hateful.
It's really interesting what they've done with Indy in this game, though, because they've sort of slightly retconned him in some ways to give him a greater level of depth. Like, he's still kind of quippy and vain, and he's brusque and patronizing in a lot of ways. But, you know, he gets his comeuppance for that in the films and here. But he's also given this, like, I don't know if this comes across at the point you're in the game at the moment, but, like, he comes across as quite respectful and caring, which are two things I would not necessarily have said about Indiana Jones as a character. But, like, they've given him a bit more of a dimension, and you get a sense of intimacy from him. And this is probably stretching the character a little further than the films, but... He very kind of like explicitly honors other cultures and their heritage, in a way which is more than lip service. And it's sort of addressed that he at least has this, you know, past as a tomb raiding colonialist. But I don't know that it very convincingly pivots him to being like a protector of other nations' history.
Yeah, it would put him very ahead of his time for a 1930s archaeologist to be thinking about that sort of stuff. But, you know, I guess that's okay. I think, I did appreciate, like, again, it would have been so easy to just do, like, Indiana Jones, what's he like? I don't know, he's a badass, I guess. He shot that guy with a big sword, and it's like, actually, the character is conceived in the movies is just more nuanced than that, right?
Yeah.
He's an academic. It belongs in a museum, as he's constantly reminding us. And, like, he's a conflicted character. He's conflicted by the side of him, which is this, you know, complete badass, and he's conflicted by the side of him that wants to preserve things for history, and to put them in the museum, which is apparently where all the antiquities of the colonized world should be. So, yeah.
Yeah, amazing vocal performance from Troy Baker. I guess that's a credit to both the writing and the acting, because they've really just nailed the voice of that character, even down to the way he says Jesus when almost being crushed by a giant rock.
I can't remember much. Were you in the running for to do the voice of Indiana Jones? Like, I think I feel like you told me that you were.
For sure, yes. I mean, Troy Baker just narrowly put me to the role, but yeah. It's an amazing the whole cast is great, really interesting characters. You might have met Gina at the point of the game you're in, which is a fairly early character. She sort of like remains your companion throughout. I was going to ask you what you think makes like a good companion to Indiana Jones, because I get the sense that it doesn't work in the same tokenized way that a Bond girl, for example, works, or even like in the way that like a Doctor Who has a capital C companion. Like they should at least feel like their own people to some degree.
It's funny because they've recreated Marcus in the game as well, right? Who was, God, the name of the actor's escaped me again. What's his name? Denham Elliot. I had that name at my fingertips and definitely didn't just have to Google it. But Denham Elliot playing Marcus, right? He's a really good like British character actor. And I don't know, I'm just thinking about who the kind of companions are. So you've got Marion in the first one. I don't know, she's an interesting one. Again, like I'm less one of those people who's kind of uncool with their relationship because, you know, she was, you know, they point out that she was basically a child when they were first together. It's kind of awful.
Yeah.
Again, even by the standards of the time there. And in the second one, you've got that lady who married Steven Spielberg and Ki-Hi Kwan as well. I don't know. It's a weird one, his companions. It's a very strange one. I quite liked it in The Last Crusade. The woman you think is going to be his companion just turns out to be a Nazi. That's good. That's funny. And actually, his companions just end up being Marcus, his dad, and Jonathan Rhys-Davies. You know, that's kind of fun as well. it's a slight ragtag bunch. I think the thing that machine games always do with their characters is that they allow them to be complicated in ways which are weirdly rare in video games. Like, characters still are often just one thing. Like, I'm an angry guy. Or like, I'm a sensitive person, or I'm a sexy person. And people in almost every single character you'll ever encounter in a machine games game is at least two things, and sometimes three things as well. And that is rare and brave and hard to do, I think.
Your friend at the Vatican is a jazz-loving, a deaf priest, right? So that's three things. I mean, in terms of like, I mean, there's a huge amount of very natural feeling breadth of representation for people of different sexualities and ethnicities and abilities. And in each case, like doesn't ever feel tokenistic or obtrusive, but it just always makes each character feel richer and more real. And they're so good at that. Like there's just each of the people that you meet in each of the kind of locations in this feels three-dimensional, and they've sketched those three dimensions with not actually that large amount of material in some cases, but they do it very well.
That thing that Quentin Smith said in his Shut Up, Sit Down video about like advice for GMs, which is like the best bit of GM advice ever for role-playing games, which is like every character you do just needs to be at the level of like a wrestler character. Like that is basically what you need to do at the table. And I think a thing that's interesting in video games is that's kind of been the rule for quite a long time because of some of the constraints of how well games can capture faces. Like, there hasn't been, until relatively recently, the ability to really capture kind of the more small performances, the more kind of subtle performances. And games have had to tend towards bigger characters or characters who are kind of one-dimensional, often really well done one-dimensional characters. But as like the facial capture techniques, you know, are incredible now, and particularly this year, they're just shooting through the roof. Some of the stuff I'm seeing at work that we're kind of looking at is incredible. And it means that you have this capacity to actually cast smaller performances, or performances which are less outsized and outrageous and subtler. Yeah. And that kind of, by definition, allows for a more diverse kind of, and a more truthful presentation of humanity, really, because you're less watchful about, you know, things being missed, because you know that the performance will be captured pretty much identically. So I think that's a nice thing about technology. And there's lots of horrible things about technology at the moment, but that's one nice thing, is that we're diversifying the kind of possibility space with that stuff.
Good game. There's lots of good villains in it as well, which is satisfying to see. But I won't spoil who they are for you, Jamie, because you've got all of these terrible characters to encounter yourself. Quite a bit of jank to go along with it. Some of the open world stuff doesn't work. You can sort of sequence break stuff in the open world. It seems like it's sort of in tension with itself in a way, weird way, because it gives you this open world, encourages you to explore, and there's like mechanical reasons for you to do so, like there's, you know, power-ups and stuff hidden, you know, various different currencies hidden around the world that you can collect to enhance yourself.
Indiana Jones famously insatiable appetite for gold and money.
Yeah, exchanging medicine bottles so you can read books and then become better at hitting people.
I interrupted you. You'll be doing that, and then you'll stumble on a place and it's like, oh no, not here, that's too far to explore.
Yes. Also, the game just bugs out occasionally, and in fact, for the last third of the game, whenever Indiana Jones touches water, he says the voice line, "It's the yak in the water," just like Sun Yen said. And he says it over and over again whenever you touch water. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I first tried to play it on my Steam Deck, which I don't recommend. I mean, they might have improved it now, but that was my first port of call, which is kind of fun because it was like, what if they'd made this game identical to the way it is now, but for the PlayStation 1? it's quite entertaining. Everyone has demonically glowing green eyes.
Oh, really?
And the sort of deep fake Alfred Molina in the opening sequence look particularly cursed and unheimly. So recommend.
It mostly worked okay for me. The frame rate in Egypt isn't great, but
true in Egypt. Famously low frame rates. It's all the sand, the particle effects.
What have you been playing, Jamie?
Hey, so I have been playing Sheeran the Wanderer 6, The Mystery of Serpent Coil Isle. So the Sheeran games, I'm forever going on about them, and I apologize. They are the mystery dungeon games from Japan, which are essentially roguelike games, traditional roguelike games that kind of sprouted off this weird sort of alternative sort of bloodline in the early 90s and have kind of been continuing ever since. I adore these games. They're sort of some of my favorite things out there. And I'll try and break them down a little bit. So yeah, Sheeran the Wanderer and The Mystery of Serpent Coil Isle. It came out last year on Switch as a Switch exclusive, and it was funny because they did a Nintendo Direct all around the world in the way that Nintendo always do. And the announcement trailer for Sheeran 6 wasn't included outside of Japan. So they just sort of assumed that no one outside of Japan would care because these games are insanely popular there. Sheeran 5, which was the previous game in the series, came out in like 2010 or something, and has been kind of periodically re-released for various kind of consoles since then, and added to and sort of supported. As I say, these games are very popular in Japan, not so much here. And so once that game was released, I think Spike Chunsoft, who made it, saw that the good numbers that it was doing, and released Sheeran 6. It's now out on Steam as well. But it did mean that because it was a Switch exclusive, I had to play it on my Switch, which I have also been doing over Christmas and the New Year. And it's annoying because Switch is a shit, right? Like, I mean, there's a wonderful console, a wonderful piece of kit, but this Switch here that I'm holding up for Marshall's inspection is a launch Switch, right? Which has been through some shit. It's got like tape along the bottom of one of the Joy-Cons. Like, this isn't the original joystick thing here. I glued this on. I think it might be stuck on with blue tack. I've replaced this Joy-Con twice. The kickstand is entirely fucked. It's just a complete piece of shit, right? And I'm so delighted that they finally announced the Switch 2. Because I am so sick of playing this fucking thing. It's a really knackered piece of kit. Hey, the Switch 2 was announced, by the way. And it's got an enormous kickstand that definitely won't break.
They were listening to you.
They were. So, Ishiren is this traditional roguelike game. It really is a traditional roguelike as well. It's sort of, because it looks kind of cutesy and Japanese and has all these kind of cute characters, it's sort of unlike any of the other games in the genre. It's turn-based, it's run-based, you have permadeath, you have, you know, random generation of dungeons. You have everything that kind of characterizes the ASCII-based roguelikes that kind of came out of the 80s, like Rogue and NetHack and Angband and all that sort of stuff, but kind of filtered through these the eyes of kind of Japanese developers into something that's kind of very similar and very different to what I was used to before. So yeah, in these games, right, you play as this guy who's got a big straw hat and a ferret, I think it is, that follows you around. You wander from place to place, and you start the game, and there's a quest to do, and the quest at the start of the game is to get to the 30th floor of this dungeon. As you do that, you kind of go upstairs or downstairs, depending on the form of dungeon, and you walk around the map, which is floor by floor, and you basically are walking around hoovering up items. The items are weapons, they're scrolls, they're various forms of grass, they're bracelets, they're pots, they're food. All of these things have a very specific function.
What does grass do for you, generally speaking?
So I can break these things down, actually. So weapons are swords and shields and various other things too, and the game is turn-based, and you always attack first. So you'll be exchanging blows with an enemy, and depending on the kind of shield or sword you have, that depends on how much damage you do and how much damage you receive. A huge part of the game as well is how full you are, is how much food Shiren has eaten. So you're constantly sort of scrabbling around for different forms of food, because the more full you are, the faster you regenerate health, just like in real life, as you know. So you want to have a nice full tum-tum. And there's plentiful onigiri that are sort of scattered around the ground, which you kind of gobble up, which I was saying to someone on Discord the other day, this game makes me exceedingly hungry because it's constantly about like snuffing up snacks and treats. So you're doing that. There's also, in this game, an added new mechanic called sumo mode, which is if you eat loads and loads of food and make your tummy really, really full, you go into sumo mode, which basically means you go into like brick shit out Shiren. You can punch down walls. You can't be like moved off your spot, and you have all these incredible buffs. So it's like, if you find yourself with loads of food, because the more food you eat, the bigger your tum-tum gets. And the bigger your tum-tum gets, the more you can regenerate health faster. So yeah, that's weapons. That's food. Grass are kind of like potions in a traditional roguelike. So these do all sorts of things. Some of them increase your strength level. Some of them cure you of the various ailments you can have. Some of them level up your character, because you're leveling up as you go up the floors. You're trying to kind of basically keep Shiren at the level of the floor he's on. So there's various ways to kind of cheat that. Whatever kind of grasses there are. There's some really mad stuff. There's some really crazy stuff in this game. You also have scrolls, which are magical scrolls, which you read and do various things, like put all the monsters on the floor to sleep, or remove all the traps from the level, because there's lots of traps, or add huge amounts of traps to the level.
why would you do that?
Add all the traps. Well, this is the thing, right? Lots of these things are often unidentified. So you sometimes don't know what they're going to do until you've eaten them read them or put them on. There's also bracelets, which give you some sort of buff or debuff. These can be like game-changing, like, you know, telling you where the monsters are on the floor, which is a huge deal, or they can do stuff like make it so that you can walk on water. There's also incense, which you can burn, which gives the level a kind of particular quality. So, for example, you can burn a kind of incense which stops any projectiles from hitting you, which is actually an incredibly game-breaking strat, because there's a particular kind of enemy that fires arrows at you. If you can have that enemy miss every single arrow it fires at you, you can pick up those arrows and just kind of fight every enemy in the game from afar with those arrows.
Oh.
There's also there's also pots. Pots are incredibly important because you can keep things in them and protect them from being stolen or rotted for your food or transformed into other items. They also do things like there's pots that you can keep on you that you can hide in. There's pots that can make all of the monsters on the level start laughing because it tells them a joke. There's pots that can heal you entirely. There's pots that are cursed, and if you try and use them, you get your hands stuck in them and you can't use your weapons. And all manner of other things that they do. There's pots that you can put items in, which turns them into money. There's pots that have seals in them that you can throw at stuff to steal. All this stuff has kind of been built up over the course of six games into this completely mad kind of universe of all of these little systems, these effects, these strategies they have for beating these dungeons. So unlike the other games, this game, it basically gives you a dungeon to beat 30 floors. Plenty of people on the Sheeran Discord will say they did it on their first go. So it's very possible to do it on your first go through. It took me 35 hours, which I was actually quite pleased with. So that's just doing the same dungeon over and over again. But it doesn't get boring because, as you can sort of hopefully hear, there's so much shit going on. There's so much stuff to do. You know, I haven't even mentioned the fact that you can fuse your weapons together to create new weapons, or that you can, you know, break the game by doing things like throwing your items in such a way that causes it to be reflected off a series of walls which duplicates them, or any number of mad stuff. There's also some story stuff happening around you. So as you're kind of trying that first dungeon, you'll meet characters, and that will slowly sort of add new mechanics to the game or new characters you can take along on your journey. One thing I don't like about this version is the graphics. It's got 3D graphics. The previous game had like beautiful pixel art, some of the most beautiful I've seen, I think. And this game has slightly janky 3D like Switch art, and it's a bit gross, to be honest. It's got beautiful music though, nice character designs, very delicious looking food. Once you beat that first dungeon, the game literally says, "That was the tutorial. The real game starts now."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And what follows is a huge amount of material to unlock. So there are dungeons that have different mechanics in them, different buffs or debuffs. So like this dungeon only has staffs in them. I didn't even mention staffs, but those are magical staffs that do a near infinite list of things. Or in this dungeon, all of the monsters are five times as big. Or in this dungeon, everyone is equipped with weapons that turns the enemies into peaches when you shoot them, and then you eat the peaches and you turn into those enemies.
What?
Yeah. And then these dungeons have like a 30-floor version or a 5-floor version, and then they go up to 99 floors. Some of these dungeons you can take items in, and that kind of, in theory, makes them quite easy because you can upgrade your items, you can go on runs, you can, you know, build up a really good supply of the kind of stuff that you need to succeed, including things like revival grass, which when you die, you automatically eat and it brings you back to life, or escape scrolls, which allow you to escape from the dungeon that you're in with all your items intact. And then you can go into some of these dungeons, which are allow carrion, is the game's language for it. And yeah, so you can rock up in those with loads of super upgraded items and kind of steamrolled them. But the kind of the real game, I guess, is these kind of non-carrion dungeons where you start off with nothing. None of the items are identified. You have to get to floor 99, which is going to take you several hours at the very, very least. And some of them, I don't even know how you would complete them. Like, some of the versions of them, they'll do like, okay, complete this 99 floor dungeon with this particular character who can't cause damage and just has to run away from everyone. So the game is this kind of mad, huge pile of stuff. And I can imagine it being quite off-putting to hear about, or certainly when you first play it, there's so much going on, so much that's specific to the game, and so much that is kind of counterintuitive in a funny kind of way. I find it just about the most satisfying gaming experience that I've had in the last year or so, in that it's so much fun puzzling out these things, learning out what strategies work, what doesn't work, what stupid shit you can do to break your game. Like, my most upgraded weapon, the one I'd spent 30 hours putting together and upgrading all the runes in it, and there's all this kind of crazy mechanics and stuff there, I made the stupid mistake of thinking a scroll I had was an upgrade scroll that would make it more powerful. Actually, what it did was turn it into a rice dumpling. And that just happened, you know, and that weapon is gone forever now. And the game will, like, allow you to do stuff like that. What it has in common with the NetHacks and the Brogues of this world is that it is brutally, brutally, brutally difficult. And for every kind of game-breaking strat that the community has come up with, the developers are in constant conversation with that. So yeah, sure, it might work on the 30-floor version of this dungeon, but on the 99 floor of this dungeon, they've got a monster that appears on floor 70 that completely obviates that particular strategy. And I find it just a completely immersive, very funny, and very rewarding experience because, you know, beating one of the post-game dungeons, I haven't beaten a single one of them. I've beaten the kind of story track ones, but there's, you know, all manner of them. It's just such an achievement because it's kind of impossible. Most of these kind of tasks are impossible, involve you, you know, finding ways to kind of dance with the various systems of the game in a way that kind of, yeah, I just find relentlessly rewarding.
When you said funny, what do you mean?
Well, because it's so easy to make stupid mistakes. So, like, yeah, turning my god weapon into a rice ball was one. It's also just funny because the game punishes you so hard that you end up having to build towards protecting yourself against outside chances. So, for example, there are traps which just trip you over, and when you trip over, you throw all your stuff on the ground, right? And then on some levels, there is a debuff caused by enemies which cause items to drop on the ground to burst into flame and burn away and die, right? And if that's your revival grass, there's no way you're reviving, so you can't die. Or if you're going to fight the last boss of the dungeon with the invincible grass, which is basically a cheat that allows you to kind of obviate their damage, if you've dropped that, then you've got to find another way through it. So it's funny in how punishing it is. The monster design is often very funny and often very stupid. There are monsters that will do things like breathe on you and turn all your weapons into food. There are monsters that will tell you jokes and make you laugh. There's monsters that will fart and transport you to another, like, zone of the level. There's, like, really cute monsters that cause, like, 999 damage and you have to, like, run away from. It's just, like, all this batshit mental stuff that I find, yeah, amusing and ridiculous. And it sets up all these wonderfully clever, procedurally kind of generated moments of chaos, right? So, for example, you will emerge into a room and suddenly the whole room will be filled with monsters, and that's called a monster house, right? And this special music will play, this, like, crazy, like, wild music will play, and there's every enemy is going to, like, converge on your spot and beat the shit out of you. And, like, working out how to get out of those situations is, again, a really satisfying emergent challenge. There's loads of ways to do it. Like, I was playing earlier and I had a staff which will turn one enemy into a decoy of you that they'll all briefly attack, right? So I did that, and I was able to kind of make my way out towards the edge of the room. However, when monsters in the game kill each other, which it did to my kind of decoy monster, they level up, right? And when they level up, they become immensely more powerful and aggressive and start hitting each other. So I had to make my way out of the room really quickly, because the longer I stayed in there, the longer the fight would continue, the more insanely powered up all these monsters would get, right? You know, and I've got like a there's a scroll in the game that you actually throw at enemies and it will like genocide every one of those creatures in the entire game. So if there's one enemy you particularly dislike, you can hit it with that scroll and it will kill out that entire species, right? So like that was my strat for that one, because most of the monsters in the room were one particular kind. And so So that's kind of the stuff that happens. It's full of these little emergent scenarios, which have millions of potential solutions, but push you to kind of think creatively in order to solve them.
When you talk about the later levels, the ones that you unlock after doing this starting dungeon, are they pre-authored? Are they proc-gen? What is it?
The way they work is that each dungeon will have a particular kind of rule or kind of, you know, you could almost call it like a mutator. So like in this dungeon, all pots are identified, so you always know what a pot does when you pick it up, rather than having to work it out.
But are you rolling that dungeon, that kind of set of circumstances, randomly, or are you picking from a menu of dungeon types?
Yeah, you pick from a menu of dungeon types.
Right.
The conditions of those dungeons are fixed. The level generation is not, so that is properly procedurally generated. Mm. You know, people have worked this out on. There's a really good wiki. Which a guy on the Discord called, on the Sheeran Discord called Shark, who's a really cool guy who I'm kind of obsessed with because he does all these like fan translations of the Sheeran games that weren't released in the West, which is great. So Sheeran 4, which I was fascinated by, he did a translation patch for that. That was a game on the PSP. I've always wondered why it wasn't released in the West. I fired it up, started playing it on my Steam Deck via emulator. And at the beginning of that game, you go to a desert island, and a few minutes after that, you meet the natives. And that was when I realized why that game was not released outside of Japan.
Oh, God.
But anyway, where was I? Yeah, so the dungeons kind of, there is a, you know, there's tables on the wiki that you can see, like, you're likely to have this certain thing on this floor. So high-level play of Sheeran is all about, like, knowing what the probabilities are of what you're likely to encounter further down the line, kind of building your sort of deck of tools towards being able to defend against that, and then hoping that certain things will or won't happen on a given floor. It's kind of unlike any sort of other roguelike game I've played in that sense, in that, giving you a kind of a real menu of things to do, and things to achieve is kind of, you know, it's sort of feels pretty unique to those games, really. And yeah, I really want more people to play it, because it's actually kind of amazing how much they put in these games, how much content there is, and how much there is to do, how deeply nerdy it is, but also how friendly it is to players. Like, it really wants, it has none of that kind of sadism of something like NetHack or even something like Slay the Spire. Like, it's kind of so amenable to you, and it wants you to have fun with it, and it wants you to kind of not give up in a way I find totally charming. The one other thing I'll say about it is it has this rescue system. So if in one of the post-game dungeons you die, and you're not, don't have any revival items or anything like that, you can request a rescue. What that does is it puts your rescue out on a online notice board, which then other players can choose to basically go in the same dungeon that you did, play that same seed, reach your character's body, revive it, which is purely done for bragging rights. Like, you don't get any actual reward. You just get up on the leaderboard of how many rescues you've done, right? And it's great because there's clearly people out there who pride themselves on being able to like rescue people from floor 88 of a 99 floor dungeon, which is going to take like 6 or 7 hours to do that. In Sheeran 5, it was always a bunch of people with Japanese names rescuing a bunch of people with Western names who were all totally shit at this game. And I used to love that because it used to give you words that you could sort of say to them you know, like arigato or whatever. And then like they would often respond with a couple of kind of words in English as well. And I always felt like it was a really touching thing. Like this person had like devoted probably hours of their life to saving some random guy on the other side of the world. And then like saying like, don't give up, you can do it. You know, along with like giving you an extra, it can leave you an extra item as well and all that sort of stuff. And I always found that like a really like touching moment of connection with someone you'll never meet.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. They're beautiful games. And they should, people should buy them and play them because then they'll make more of them.
Well, what could they possibly do in Sheeran 7?
Yeah, that's what they said after Sheeran 5. It's funny because the Discord is full of people who only play these games and are furious at them every step of the way for things that they do wrong, things that were better in the last game. You know, there's people who are saying like Sheeran 1 was easily the best one, or
of course,
you know, there's a completely like horrific looking one for the N64 that lots of people will go to task for that I've never played. It's kind of, but it's fascinating. The Sheeran, the original one was on the SNES and is really worth playing via emulator. It's a really beautiful SNES roguelike that like really holds up today. So yeah, Sheeran the Wanderer, play it.
No, but I enjoyed hearing about it.
Did you? It didn't sound like the deluded ramblings of a madman.
It does. It sounds like the kind of game I wish I was a good enough person to play. But I'm.
But I am an idiot, right? Whenever I hear anyone on our Discord saying like, "Oh, I'm just about to get to Ascension level 3000 of Slay the Spire," or whatever, I'm like, I could just as much, you know, I can't even think of what I couldn't do before I could do that. Like, I'm an idiot. I'm a moron.
It's not even like ability. It's more like, I don't know what the kind of ludic equivalent of being cultured is. Like, I think over time I've decultured. I've become basically a slime that only imbibes narrative games and mass market games in very small quantities because I don't have much time. I have a sort of like distant appreciation of mechanically interesting, incredibly intricate proc gen interactions and things like that. But I don't have the yen to sink time into that. I don't know why not, really, because I do like hearing about it. But maybe it's partly because whenever I hear Graham or yourself talk about one of these fantastic procedural games, you already have the story that I wish I would have. And then I play it and it's just like, you know, I'm just some little shambling Burke who immediately dies in an extremely boring way.
They're very funny because they're relentlessly misunderstood. Like you can go back and read the review of like pretty much every Sheeran game where, because they were the sort of most high-profile traditional roguelike releases, really, you get lots of reviews of them. We're like, you lose all your progress when you die. Like, what the fuck? Like, this game is a mistake. People just thought it was completely insane. You know, in the sort of 2004, no one knew what a fucking roguelike was, you know, until Derek Yu told everyone. So it's kind of funny seeing that. I will say that the PC Gamer review of it was brilliant and was, I'll put that in the show notes, because they totally got it in the way that the Eurogamer review totally didn't.
Oh, I wonder who did that. I'll read that with interest.
Good. Wow. Is that all the pod we've got time for?
If you wish it to be, it can be.
I am sweating.
Well, I'll let you clamber into your bunk bed and sweat away. If you'd like to send us a question, you can do so at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. All these recordings are uploaded as videos to YouTube, where you can find other stuff. By us, the address for that is youtube.com/crateandcrowbar. And thanks, as always, to our backers on Patreon. You can back us too at patreon.com/crateandcrowbar, or you can simply join our very lovely Discord community, the link for which is on our website, crateandcrowbar.com. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
I've been an increasingly incoherent Jamie Britton.
Don't do yourself down, Jamie. That was very nice.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.